Hachette Audio presents The Brass Verdict by Michael Connelly, read by Peter Giles.
In memory of Terry Hansen and Frank Morgan. Part 1. Rope-a-dope, 1992. Everybody lies. Cops lie. Lawyers lie. Witnesses lie. The victims lie. A trial is a contest of lies, and everybody in the courtroom knows this. The judge knows this. Even the jury knows this. They come into the building knowing they will be lied to. They take their seats in the box and agree to be lied to. The trick, if you're sitting at the defense table, is to be patient, to wait, not for just any lie, but for the one you can grab onto and forge like hot iron into a sharpened blade. You then use that blade to rip the case open and spill its guts out on the floor. That's my job, to forge the blade, to sharpen it, to use it without mercy or conscience, to be the truth in a place where everybody lies. I was in the fourth day of trial in Department 109 in the downtown criminal courts building when I got the lie that became the blade that ripped the case open. My client, Barnett Woodson, was riding two murder charges all the way to the steel gray room in San Quentin, where they serve you Jesus juice direct through the arm. Woodson, a 27-year-old drug dealer from Compton, was accused of robbing and killing two college students from Westwood. They had wanted to buy cocaine from him. He decided instead to take their money and kill them both with a sawed-off shotgun, or so the prosecution said. It was a black-on-white crime, and that made things bad enough for Woodson, especially coming just 4 months after the riots that had torn the city apart. But what made his situation even worse was that the killer had attempted to hide the crime by weighing down the two bodies and dropping them into the Hollywood Reservoir. They stayed down for 4 days before popping to the surface like apples in a barrel. Rotten apples. The idea of dead bodies moldering in the reservoir that was a primary source of the city's drinking water caused a collective twist in the community's guts. When Woodson was linked by phone records to the dead men and arrested, the public outrage directed toward him was almost palpable. The district attorney's office promptly announced it would seek the death penalty. The case against Woodson, however, wasn't all that palpable. It was constructed largely of circumstantial evidence, the phone records, and the testimony of witnesses who were criminals themselves. And state's witness Ronald Torrance sat front and center in this group. He claimed that Woodson confessed the killings to him. Torrance had been housed on the same floor of the men's central jail as Woodson. Both men were kept in a high-power module that contained 16 single-prisoner cells on two tiers that opened onto a day room. At the time, all 16 prisoners in the module were black, following the routine but questionable jail procedure of segregating for safety, which entailed dividing prisoners according to race and gang affiliation to avoid confrontations and violence. Torrance was awaiting trial on robbery and aggravated assault charges stemming from his involvement in looting during the riots. High-powered detainees had 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. access to the day room, where they ate and played cards at tables, and otherwise interacted under the watchful eyes of guards in an overhead glass booth. According to Torrance, it was at one of these tables that my client had confessed to killing the two Westside boys. The prosecution went out of its way to make Torrance presentable and believable to the jury, which had only three black members. He was given a shave, his hair was taken out of cornrows and trimmed short, and he was dressed in a pale blue suit with no tie when he arrived in court on the fourth day of Woodson's trial. In direct testimony elicited by Jerry Vincent, the prosecutor, Torrance described the conversation he allegedly had with Woodson one morning at one of the picnic tables. Woodson not only confessed to the killings, he said, but furnished Torrance with many of the telling details of the murders. The point made clear to the jury was that these were details that only the true killer would know. During the testimony, Vincent kept Torrance on a tight leash with long questions designed to elicit short answers. The questions were overloaded to the point of being leading, but I didn't bother objecting. Even when Judge Compagnoni looked at me with raised eyebrows, practically begging me to jump in, But I didn't object, because I wanted the counterpoint. I wanted the jury to see what the prosecution was doing. When it was my turn, I was going to let Torrance run with his answers while I hung back and waited for the blade. Vincent finished his direct at 11 a.m., and the judge asked me if I wanted to take an early lunch before I began my cross. I told him no, I didn't need or want a break. I said it like I was disgusted and couldn't wait another hour to get at the man on the stand. I stood up and took a big, thick file and legal pad with me to the lectern.
Mr. Torrance, my name is Michael Haller. I work for the Public Defender's Office and represent Barnett Woodson. Have we met before?
No, sir.
I didn't think so, but you and the defendant, Mr. Woodson, you two go back a long way, correct? Torrance gave an aw shucks smile, but I had done the due diligence on him and I knew exactly who I was dealing with. He was 32 years old and had spent a third of his life in jails and prisons. His schooling had ended in the fourth grade, when he stopped going to school and no parent seemed to notice or care. Under the state's three-strike law, he was facing a lifetime achievement award if convicted of charges he robbed and pistol-whipped the female manager of a coin laundry. The crime had been committed during 3 days of rioting and looting that ripped through the city after the not guilty verdicts were announced in the trial of four police officers accused of the excessive beating of Rodney King, a black motorist pulled over for driving erratically. In short, Torrance had good reason to help the state take down Barnett Woodson.
Well, we go back a few months is all, Torrance said, to high power.
Did you say higher power? I asked, playing dumb. Are you talking about a church or some sort of religious connection?
No, high power module, in county.
So you're talking about jail, correct?
That's right.
So you're telling me that you didn't know Barnett Woodson before that? I asked the question with surprise in my voice.
No, sir, we met for the first time in the jail.
I made a note on the legal pad, as if this were an important concession.
So then let's do the math, Mr. Torrance. Barnett Woodson was transferred into the high-power module where you were already residing on the 5th of September earlier this year. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember him coming in, yeah.
And why were you there in high power?
Vincent stood and objected, saying I was covering ground he had already trod in direct testimony. I argued that I was looking for a fuller explanation of Torrance's incarceration, and Judge Compagnoni allowed me the leeway. He told Torrance to answer the question.
Like I said, I got a count of assault and one of robbery. And these alleged crimes took place during the riots, is that correct?
With the anti-police climate permeating the city's minority communities since even before the riots, I had fought during jury selection to get as many blacks and browns on the panel as I could. But here was a chance to work on the five white jurors the prosecution had been able to get by me. I wanted them to know that the man the prosecution was hanging so much of its case on was one of those responsible for the images they saw on their television sets back in May.
Yeah, I was out there like everybody else, Torrance answered. Cops get away with too much in this town, you ask me.
I nodded like I agreed.
And your response to the injustice of the verdicts in the Rodney King beating case was to go out and rob a 62-year-old woman and knock her unconscious with a steel trash can. Is that correct, sir?
Torrance looked over at the prosecution table and then passed Vincent to his own lawyer, sitting in the first row of the gallery. Whether or not they had earlier rehearsed a response to this question, his legal team couldn't help Torrance now. He was on his own.
I didn't do that, he finally said.
You're innocent of the crime you're charged with?
That's right.
What about looting? You committed no crimes during the riots? After a pause and another glance at his attorney, Torrance said,
I take the fifth on that.
As expected. I then took Torrance through a series of questions designed so that he had no choice but to incriminate himself or refuse to answer under the protections of the Fifth Amendment. Finally, after he took the nickel 6 times, the judge grew weary of the point being made over and over and prodded me back to the case at hand. I reluctantly complied.
All right, enough about you, Mr. Torrance, I said. Let's get back to you and Mr. Woodson.
You knew the details of this double murder case before you even met Mr. Woodson in lockup?
No, sir.
Are you sure? It got a lot of attention.
I've been in jail, man.
They don't have television or newspapers in jail? I don't read no papers, and the module's TV been broke since I got there. We made a fuss and they said they'd fix it, but they ain't fixed shit.
The judge admonished Torrance to check his language, and the witness apologized. I moved on. According to the jail's records, Mr. Woodson arrived in the high-power module on the 5th of September, and, according to the state's discovery material, you contacted the prosecution on October 2nd to report his alleged confession. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Well, not to me, Mr. Torrance. You're telling this jury that a man accused of a double murder and facing the possible death penalty confessed to a man he had known for less than 4 weeks?
Torrance shrugged before answering.
That's what happened.
So you say, what will you get from the prosecution if Mr. Woodson is convicted of these crimes?
I don't know. Nobody's promised me nothing.
With your prior record and the charges you currently face, you're looking at more than 15 years in prison if you're convicted, correct?
I don't know about any of that.
You don't?
No, sir. I let my lawyer handle all that.
He hasn't told you that if you don't do something about this, you might go to prison for a long, long time?
He hasn't told me none of that.
I see. What have you asked the prosecutor for in exchange for your testimony?
Nothing. I don't want nothing.
So then, you are testifying here because you believe it is your duty as a citizen. Is that correct?
The sarcasm in my voice was unmistakable.
That's right,
Torrance responded indignantly. I held the thick file up over the lectern so he could see it.
Do you recognize this file, Mr. Torrance?
No, not that I recall, I don't.
You sure you don't remember seeing it in Mr. Woodson's cell?
Never been in his cell.
Are you sure that you didn't sneak in there and look through his discovery file while Mr. Woodson was in the day room or in the shower or maybe in court sometime?
No, I did not.
My client had many of the investigative documents relating to his prosecution in his cell. These contained several of the details he testified to this morning.
You don't think that is suspicious?
Torrance shook his head.
No. All I know is that he sat there at the table and told me what he'd done. He was feeling poorly about it and opened up to me. It ain't my fault people open up to me.
I nodded, as if sympathetic to the burden Torrance carried as a man others confided in, especially when it came to double murders.
Of course not, Mr. Torrance. Now can you tell the jury exactly what he said to you? And don't use the shorthand you used when Mr. Vincent was asking the questions. I want to hear exactly what my client told you. Give us his words, please.
Torrance paused, as if to probe his memory and compose his thoughts.
Well, he finally said, we were sitting there, the both of us, by ourselves, and he just started talking about feeling bad about what he'd done. I asked him, what did you do? And he told me about that night he killed the two fellas and how he felt pretty rough about it.
The truth is short. Lies are long. I wanted to get Torrance talking in long form, something Vincent had successfully avoided. Jailhouse snitches have something in common with all con men and professional liars. They seek to hide the con in misdirection and banter. They wrap cotton around their lies. But in all of that fluff, you often find the key to revealing the big lie. Vincent objected again, saying the witness had already answered the questions I was asking, and I was simply badgering him at this point.
Your Honor, I responded, this witness is putting a confession in my client's mouth. As far as the defense is concerned, this is the case, right here. The court would be remiss if it did not allow me to fully explore the content and context of such damaging testimony.
Judge Compagnoni was nodding in agreement before I finished the last sentence. He overruled Vincent's objection and told me to proceed. I turned my attention back to the witness and spoke with impatience in my voice.
Mr. Torrance, you are still summarizing. You claim Mr. Woodson confessed to the murders. So then, tell the jury what he said to you. What were the exact words he said to you when he confessed to this crime?
Torrance nodded, as if he were just then realizing what I was asking for.
The first thing he said to me was, "Man, I feel bad." And I said, for what, my brother? He said he kept thinking about those two guys. I didn't know what he was talking about, because, like I said, I hadn't heard nothing about the case, you know? So I said, what two guys?
and he said, the two niggers I dumped in the reservoir. I asked what he was all about, and he told me about blasting them both with a shorty and wrapping them up in chicken wire and such. He said, I made one bad mistake, and I asked him what it was. He said, I should have taken a knife and opened up their bellies so they wouldn't end up floating to the top the way they did. And that was what he told me. In my peripheral vision, I had seen Vincent flinch in the middle of Torrance's long answer, and I knew why. I carefully moved in with the blade. Did Mr. Woodson use that word? He called the victims niggers. Yeah, he said that. I hesitated as I worked on the phrasing of the next question. I knew Vincent was waiting to object if I gave him the opening. I could not ask Torrance to interpret. I couldn't use the word why when it came to Woodson's meaning or motivation. That was objectionable. Mr. Torrance, in the black community, the word nigger could mean different things, could it not? Spose? Is that a yes? Yes. The defendant is African American, correct? Torrance laughed. Looks like it to me. As are you, correct, sir? Torrance started to laugh again. Since I was born, he said. The judge tapped his gavel once and looked at me. Mr. Holler, is this really necessary? I apologize, Your Honor. Please move on. Mr. Torrance, when Mr. Woodson used that word, as you say he did it shock you? Torrance rubbed his chin as he thought about the question. Then he shook his head. Not really. Why weren't you shocked, Mr. Torrance? I guess it's 'cause I hear it all the time, man. From other black men. That's right. I heard it from white folks, too. Well, when fellow black men use that word like you say Mr. Woodson did, who are they talking about? Vincent objected, saying that Torrance could not speak for what other men were talking about. Compagnoni sustained the objection, and I took a moment to rework the path to the answer I wanted. Okay, Mr. Torrance, I finally said. Let's talk only about you then, okay? Do you use that word on occasion? I think I have. All right. And when you have used it, who were you referring to? Torrance shrugged. Other fellas. Other black men. That's right. Have you ever on occasion referred to white men as niggers? Torrance shook his head. No. Okay. So then, what did you take the meaning to be when Barnett Woodson described the two men who were dumped in the reservoir as niggers? Vincent moved in his seat, going through the body language of making an objection, but not verbally following through with it. He must have known it would be useless. I had led Torrance down the path and he was mine. Torrance answered the question. I took it that they were black, and he killed them both. Now Vincent's body language changed again. He sank a little bit in his seat, because he knew his gamble in putting a jailhouse snitch on the witness stand had just come up snake eyes. I looked up at Judge Compagnoni. He knew what was coming as well. Your Honor, may I approach the witness? You may, the judge said. I walked to the witness stand and put the file down in front of Torrance. It was legal size, well-worn and faded orange, a color used by county jailers to denote private legal documents that an inmate is authorized to possess. Okay, Mr. Torrance, I have placed before you a file in which Mr. Woodson keeps discovery documents provided to him in jail by his attorneys. I ask you once again if you recognize it. I've seen a lot of orange files in high power. It don't mean I've seen that one. You were saying you never saw Mr. Woodson with his file. I don't rightly remember. Mr. Torrance, you were with Mr. Woodson in the same module for 32 days. You testified he confided in you and confessed to you. Are you saying you never saw him with that file? He didn't answer at first. I had backed him into a no-win corner. I waited. If he continued to claim he had never seen the file, then his claim of a confession from Woodson would be suspect in the eyes of the jury. If he finally conceded that he was familiar with the file, then he opened a big door for me. What I'm saying is, I seen him with his file, but I never looked at what was in it. Bang. I had him. Then I'll ask you to open the file and inspect it. The witness followed the instruction and looked from side to side at the open file. I went back to the lectern, checking on Vincent on my way. His eyes were downcast and his face was pale. What do you see when you open the file, Mr. Torrance? One side's got photos of two bodies on the ground. They're stapled in there. With the photos, I mean. And the other side is a bunch of documents and reports and such. Could you read from the first document there on the right side? Just read the first line of the summary. No, I can't read. You can't read at all. Not really. I didn't get the schooling. Can you read any of the words that are next to the boxes that are checked at the top of the summary? Torrance looked down at the file, and his eyebrows came together in concentration. I knew that his reading skills had been tested during his last stint in prison and were determined to be at the lowest measurable level, below second grade skills. Not really, he said. I can't read. I quickly walked over to the defense table and grabbed another file and a Sharpie pen out of my briefcase. I went back to the lectern and quickly printed the word Caucasian on the outside of the file in large block letters. I held the file up so that Torrance, as well as the jury, could see it. Mr. Torrance, this is one of the words checked on the summary. Can you read this word? Vincent immediately stood, but Torrance was already shaking his head and looking thoroughly humiliated. Vincent objected to the demonstration without proper foundation, and Compagnoni sustained. I expected him to. I was just laying the groundwork for my next move with the jury, and I was sure most of them had seen the witness shake his head. Okay, Mr. Torrance, I said. Let's move to the other side of the file. Could you describe the bodies in the photos? Two men? Looks like they open up some chicken wire and some tarps and they're laying there. A bunch of police is there investigating and taking pictures. What race are the men on the tarps? They're black. Have you ever seen those photographs before, Mr. Torrance? Vincent stood to object to my question as having previously been asked and answered, but it was like holding up a hand to stop a bullet. The judge sternly told him he could take his seat. It was his way of telling the prosecutor he was going to have to just sit back and take what was coming. You put the liar on the stand, you take the fall with him. You may answer the question, Mr. Torrance, I said after Vincent sat down. Have you ever seen those photographs before? No, sir, not before right now. Would you agree that the pictures portray what you described to us earlier, that being the bodies of two slain black men? That's what it looks like, but I ain't seen the picture before, just what he tell me. Are you sure? Something like these I wouldn't forget. You've told us Mr. Woodson confessed to killing two black men, but he is on trial for killing two white men. Wouldn't you agree that it appears that he didn't confess to you at all? No, he confessed. He told me he killed those two. I looked up at the judge. Your Honor, the defense asked that the file in front of Mr. Torrance be admitted into evidence as Defense Exhibit 1. Vincent made a lack of foundation objection, but Compagnoni overruled. It will be admitted and we'll let the jury decide whether Mr. Torrance has or hasn't seen the photographs and contents of the file. I was on a roll and decided to go all in. Thank you, I said. Your Honor, now might also be a good time for the prosecutor to reacquaint his witness with the penalties for perjury. It was a dramatic move, made for the benefit of the jury. I was expecting I would have to continue with Torrance and eviscerate him with the blade of his own lie. But Vincent stood and asked the judge to recess the trial while he conferred with opposing counsel. This told me I had just saved Barnett Woodson's life. The defense has no objection, I told the judge. After the jury filed out of the box, I returned to the defense table as the courtroom deputy was moving in to cuff my client and take him back to the courtroom holding cell. That guy's a lying sack of shit, Woodson whispered to me. I didn't kill two black guys, they were white. My hope was that the deputy hadn't heard that. Why don't you shut the fuck up, I whispered right back. And next time you see that lying sack of shit in lockup, you ought to shake his hand. Because of his lies, the prosecutor's about to come off of the death penalty and float a deal. I'll be back there to tell you about it as soon as I get it. Woodson shook his head dramatically. Yeah, well, maybe I don't want no deal now. They put a goddamn liar on the stand, man. This whole case should go down the toilet. We can win this motherfucker, Holla. Don't take no deal. I stared at Woodson for a moment. I'd just saved his life, but he wanted more. He felt entitled because the state hadn't played fair. Never mind responsibility for the two kids he had just admitted to killing. Don't get greedy, Barnett, I told him. I'll be back with the news as soon as I get it. The deputy took him through the steel door that led to the holding cells attached to the courtroom. I watched him go. I had no false conceptions about Barnett Woodson. I had never directly asked him, but I knew he had killed those two Westside boys. That wasn't my concern. My job was to test the state's case against him with the best of my skills. That's how the system worked. I had done that, and had been given the blade. I would now use it to improve his situation significantly, but Woodson's dream of walking away from those two bodies that had turned black in the water was not in the cards. He might not have understood this, but his underpaid and underappreciated public defender certainly did. After the courtroom cleared, Vincent and I were left looking at each other from our respective tables. So, I said. Vincent shook his head. First of all, he said, I want to make it clear that obviously I didn't know Torrance was lying.
Sure.
Why would I sabotage my own case like this? I waved off the mea culpa. Look, Jerry, don't bother. I told you in pre-trial that the guy had copped the discovery my client had in his cell. It's common sense. My guy wouldn't have said shit to your guy, a perfect stranger, and everybody knew it except you. Vincent emphatically shook his head. I did not know it, Holler. He came forward, was vetted by one of our best investigators, and there was no indication of a lie, no matter how improbable it would seem that your client talked to him. I laughed that off in an unfriendly way. Not talk to him, Cherry. Confess to him. A little difference there. So you better check with this prized investigator of yours because he isn't worth the county paycheck. Look, he told me the guy couldn't read, so there was no way he could have gotten what he knew out of the discovery. He didn't mention the photos. Exactly. And that's why you should find yourself a new investigator. And I'll tell you what, Jerry, I'm usually pretty reasonable about this sort of stuff. I try to go along to get along with the DA's office, but I gave you fair warning about this guy. So after the break, I'm gonna gut him right there on the stand, and all you're gonna be able to do is sit there and watch. I was in full outrage now, and a lot of it was real. It's called rope-a-dope, but when I'm done with Torrance, he's not the only one who's gonna look like a dope. That jury's gonna know that you either knew this guy was a liar or you were too dumb to realize it. Either way, you're not coming off too good. Vincent looked down blankly at the prosecution table and calmly straightened the case files stacked in front of him. He spoke in a quiet voice. I don't want you going forward with the cross, he said. Fine. Then cut the denials and the bullshit and give me a dispo I'll drop the death penalty. 25 to life without. I shook my head without hesitation. That's not gonna do it. The last thing Woodson said before they took him back was that he was willing to roll the dice. To be exact, he said, we can win this motherfucker. And I think he could be right. Then, what do you want, Holler? I'll go 15 max. I think I can sell that to him. Vincent emphatically shook his head. No way. They'll send me back to filing by-bus if I give you that for two cold-blooded murders. My best offer is 25 with parole. That's it. Under current guidelines, he could be out in 16, 17 years. Not bad for what he did, killing two kids like that. I looked at him, trying to read his face, looking for the tell. I decided I believed it was going to be the best he would do. And he was right. It wasn't a bad deal for what Barnett Woodson had done. I don't know, I said. I think he'll say roll the dice. Vincent shook his head and looked at me. Then you'll have to sell it to him, Holler. Because I can't go lower, and if you continue the cross, then my career in the DA's office is probably finished. Now I hesitated before responding. Wait a minute. What are you saying, Jerry? That I have to clean your mess up for you? I catch you with your pants around your ankles, and it's my client that has to take it in the ass? I'm saying it's a fair offer to a man who is guilty as sin. More than fair. Go talk to him and work your magic, Mick. Convince him. We both know you're not long for the public defender's office. You might need a favor from me someday when you're out there in the big bad world with no steady paycheck coming in. I just stared back at him, registering the quid pro quo of the offer. I help him, and somewhere down the line he helps me. and Barnett Woodson does an extra couple of years in stir.
He'll be lucky to last 5 years in there, let alone 20, Vincent said. What's the difference to him? But you and I, we're going places, Mickey. We can help each other here.
I nodded slowly. Vincent was only a few years older than me, but was trying to act like some kind of wise old sage.
The thing is, Jerry, if I did what you suggest, then I'd never be able to look another client in the eye again. I think I'd end up being the dope that got roped.
I stood up and gathered my files. My plan was to go back and tell Barnett Woodson to roll the dice, and let me see what I could do. I'll see you after the break, I said. And then I walked away.
Part 2. Suitcase City, 2007. It was a little early in the week for Lorna Taylor to be calling and checking on me. Usually she waited until at least Thursday, never Tuesday. I picked up the phone, thinking it was more than a check-in call.
Lorna.
Mickey, where have you been? I've been calling all morning.
I went for my run. I just got out of the shower. You okay?
I'm fine. Are you?
Sure. What is...
You got a forthwith from Judge Holder. She wants to see you. Like an hour ago.
This gave me pause. About what?
I don't know. All I know is first Michaela called, then the judge herself called. That usually doesn't happen. She wanted to know why you weren't responding.
I knew that Michaela was Michaela Gill, the judge's clerk, and Mary Towns Holder was the chief judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court. The fact that she had called personally didn't make it sound like they were inviting me to the annual justice ball. Mary Towns Holder didn't call lawyers without a good reason.
What did you tell her?
I just said you didn't have court today and you might be out on the golf course.
I don't play golf, Lorna.
Look, I couldn't think of anything.
It's all right. I'll call the judge. Give me the number.
Mickey, don't call. Just go. The judge wants to see you in chambers. She was very clear about that and she wouldn't tell me why. So just go.
Okay, I'm going. I have to get dressed.
Mickey?
What?
How are you really doing?
I knew her code. I knew what she was asking. She didn't want me appearing in front of a judge if I wasn't ready for it.
You don't have to worry, Lorna. I'm fine. I'll be fine.
Okay. Call me and let me know what is going on as soon as you can.
Don't worry. I will. I hung up the phone, feeling like I was being bossed around by my wife, not my ex-wife.
As the chief judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, Judge Mary Towns Holder did most of her work behind closed doors. Her courtroom was used on occasion for emergency hearings on motions, but rarely used for trials. Her work was done out of the view of the public, in chambers. Her job largely pertained to the administration of the justice system in Los Angeles County. More than 250 judgeships and 40 courthouses fell under her purview. Every jury summons that went into the mail had her name on it, and every assigned parking space in a courthouse garage had her approval. She assigned judges by both geography and designation of law: criminal, civil, juvenile, and family. When judges were newly elected to the bench, it was Judge Holder who decided whether they sat in Beverly Hills or Compton, and whether they heard high-stakes financial cases in civil court or soul-draining divorce cases in family court. I had dressed quickly in what I considered my lucky suit. It was an Italian import from Corneliani that I used to wear on verdict days. Since I hadn't been in court for a year, or heard a verdict for even longer, I had to take it out of a plastic bag hanging in the back of the closet. After that, I sped downtown without delay, thinking that I might be headed towards some sort of verdict on myself. As I drove, my mind raced over the cases and clients I had left behind a year earlier. As far as I knew, nothing had been left open or on the table. But maybe there had been a complaint, or the judge had picked up on some courthouse gossip and was running her own inquiry. Regardless, I entered Holder's courtroom with a lot of trepidation. A summons from any judge was usually not good news. A summons from the chief judge was even worse. The courtroom was dark, and the clerk's pod next to the bench was empty. I walked through the gate and was heading toward the door to the back hallway when it opened and the clerk stepped through it. Michaela Gill was a pleasant-looking woman who reminded me of my third-grade teacher.
but she wasn't expecting to find a man approaching the other side of the door when she opened it. She startled and nearly let out a shriek. I quickly identified myself before she could make a run for the panic button on the judge's bench. She caught her breath and then ushered me back without delay. I walked down the hallway and found the judge alone in her chambers, working at a massive desk made of dark wood. Her black robe was hanging on a hat rack in the corner. She was dressed in a maroon suit with a conservative cut. She was attractive and neat, mid-50s, with a slim build and brown hair kept in a short, no-nonsense style. I had never met Judge Holder before, but I knew about her. She had put 20 years in as a prosecutor before being appointed to the bench by a conservative governor. She presided over criminal cases, had a few of the big ones, and was known for handing out maximum sentences. Consequently, she had been easily retained by the electorate after her first term. She'd been elected chief judge 4 years later and had held the position ever since. "Mr. Haller, thank you for coming," she said. "I'm glad your secretary finally found you." There was an impatient, if not imperious, tone to her voice. "She's not actually my secretary, Judge, but she found me. Sorry it took so long." "Well, you're here. I don't believe we have met before, have we?"
"I don't think so."
"Well, this will betray my age, but I actually opposed your father in a trial once. One of his last cases, I believe." I had to readjust my estimate of her age. She would have to be at least 60 if she had ever been in a courtroom with my father. "I was actually third chair on a case, just out of USC law and green as can be. They were trying to give me some trial exposure. It was a murder case and they let me handle one witness. I prepared a week for my examination, and your father destroyed the man on cross in 10 minutes. We won the case, but I never forgot the lesson. Be prepared for anything." I nodded. Over the years, I had met several older lawyers who had Mickey Haller Sr. stories to share. I had very few of my own. Before I could ask the judge about the case on which she'd met him, she pressed on. "But that's not why I called you here," she said. "I didn't think so, Judge. It sounded like you have something kind of urgent." "I do. Did you know Jerry Vincent?" I was immediately thrown by her use of the past tense.
"Jerry? Yes, I know Jerry. What about him?"
"He's dead."
"Dead?"
"Murdered, actually."
"When?"
"Last night. I'm sorry." My eyes dropped, and I looked at the nameplate on her desk. Honorable M.T. Holder was carved in script into a two-dimensional wooden display that held a ceremonial gavel and a fountain pen and inkwell.
"How close were you?" she asked.
It was a good question, and I didn't really know the answer. I kept my eyes down as I spoke. "We had cases against each other when he was with the DA, and I was at the PD. We both left for private practice around the same time, and both of us had one-man shops. Over the years, we worked some cases together, a couple of drug trials, and we sort of covered for each other when it was needed. He threw me a case occasionally when it was something he didn't want to handle." I had had a professional relationship with Jerry Vincent. Every now and then, we clicked glasses at Four Green Fields or saw each other at a ball game at Dodgers Stadium. But for me to say we were close would have been an exaggeration. I knew little about him outside the world of law. I had heard about a divorce a while back on the courthouse gossip line, but had never even asked him about it. That was personal information, and I didn't need to know it. "You seem to forget, Mr. Haller, but I was with the DA back when Mr. Vincent was a young up-and-comer. But then he lost a big case and his star faded. That was when he left for private practice." I looked at the judge but said nothing. "And I seem to recall that you were the defense attorney on that case," she added. I nodded. "Barnett Woodson. I got an acquittal on a double murder. He walked out of the courtroom and sarcastically apologized to the media for getting away with murder. He had to rub the DA's face in it, and that pretty much ended Jerry's career as a prosecutor."
"Then why would he ever work with you or throw you cases?"
"Because, Judge, by ending his career as a prosecutor, I started his career as a defense attorney." I left it at that, but it wasn't enough for her.
"And?"
"And a couple of years later, he was making about 5 times what he had made with the DA. He called me up one day and thanked me for showing him the light."
The judge nodded knowingly. "It came down to money. He wanted the money." I shrugged like I was uncomfortable answering for a dead man and didn't respond.
What happened to your client? The judge asked. What became of the man who got away with murder?
He would have been better off taking a conviction. Woodson got killed in a drive-by about 2 months after the acquittal. The judge nodded again, this time as if to say, end of story, justice served. I tried to put the focus back on Jerry Vincent.
I can't believe this about Jerry. Do you know what happened?
That's not clear. He was apparently found late last night in his car, in the garage at his office. He'd been shot to death. I'm told that the police are still there at the crime scene and there have been no arrests.
All of this comes from a Times reporter who called my chambers to make an inquiry about what will happen now with Mr. Vincent's clients, especially Walter Elliott. I nodded. For the last 12 months, I'd been in a vacuum, but it wasn't so airtight that I hadn't heard about the movie mogul murder case. It was just one in a string of big-time cases Vincent had scored over the years. Despite the Woodson fiasco, his pedigree as a high-profile prosecutor had set him up from the start as an upper-echelon criminal defense attorney. He didn't have to go looking for clients. They came looking for him. And usually, they were clients who could pay or had something to say, meaning they had at least one of three attributes. They could pay top dollar for legal representation, they were demonstrably innocent of the charges lodged against them, or they were clearly guilty but had public opinion and sentiment on their side. These were clients he could get behind and forthrightly defend no matter what they were accused of. Clients who didn't make him feel greasy at the end of the day. And Walter Elliott qualified for at least one of those attributes. He was the chairman/owner of Archway Pictures and a very powerful man in Hollywood. He had been charged with murdering his wife and her lover in a fit of rage after discovering them together in a Malibu beach house. The case had all sorts of connections to sex and celebrity and was drawing wide media attention. It had been a publicity machine for Vincent, and now it would go up for grabs. The judge broke through my reverie.
Are you familiar with RPC 2300? She asked.
I involuntarily gave myself away by squinting my eyes at the question.
Not exactly.
Let me refresh your memory. It is the section of the California Bar's Rules of Professional Conduct referring to the transfer or sale of a law practice. We, of course, are talking about a transfer in this case. Mr. Vincent apparently named you as his second in his standard contract of representation. This allowed you to cover for him when he needed it and included you, if necessary, in the attorney-client relationship. Additionally, I have found that he filed a motion with the court 10 years ago that allowed for the transfer of his practice to you should he become incapacitated or deceased. The motion has never been altered or updated, but it's clear what his intentions were.
I just stared at her. I knew about the clause in Vincent's standard contract. I had the same in mine, naming him. But what I realized was that the judge was telling me that I now had Jerry's cases, all of them. Walter Elliott included. This, of course, did not mean I would keep all of the cases. Each client would be free to move on to another attorney of their choosing once apprised of Vincent's demise, but it meant that I would have the first shot at them. I started thinking about things. I hadn't had a client in a year, and the plan was to start back slow, not with a full caseload like the one I had apparently just inherited. However, the judge said, before you get too excited about this proposition, I must tell you that I would be remiss in my role as chief judge if I did not make every effort to ensure that Mr. Vincent's clients were transferred to a replacement counsel of good standing and competent skill. Now I understood. She had called me in to explain why I would not be appointed to Vincent's clients. She was going to go against the dead lawyer's wishes and appoint somebody else, most likely one of the high-dollar contributors to her last re-election campaign. Last I had checked, I'd contributed exactly nothing to her coffers over the years. But then the judge surprised me.
I've checked with some of the judges, she said, and I am aware that you have not been practicing law for almost a year. I've found no explanation for this. Before I issue the order appointing you replacement counsel in this matter, I need to be assured that I am not turning Mr. Vincent's clients over to the wrong man. I nodded in agreement, hoping it would buy me a little time before I had to respond.
Judge, you're right. I sort of took myself out of the game for a while.
but I just started taking steps to get back in. Why did you take yourself out?
She asked it bluntly, her eyes holding mine and looking for anything that would indicate evasion of the truth in my answer. I spoke very carefully.
Judge, I had a case a couple of years ago. The client's name was Louis Roulet.
I remember the case, Mr. Haller. You got shot.
But, as you say, that was a couple of years ago. I seem to remember you practicing law for some time after that. I remember the news stories about you coming back to the job.
Well, I said, what happened is, I came back too soon. I'd been gut shot, Judge, and I should have taken my time. Instead, I hurried back, and the next thing I knew, I started having pain, and the doctor said I had a hernia. So I had an operation for that, and there were complications. They did it wrong. There was even more pain, and another operation, and, well, to make a long story short, it knocked me down for a while. I decided the second time not to come back until I was sure I was ready.
The judge nodded sympathetically. I guessed I had been right to leave out the part about my addiction to pain pills and the stint in rehab.
Money wasn't an issue, I said. I had some savings, and I also got a settlement from the insurance company, so I took my time coming back. But I'm ready. I was just about to take the back cover of the Yellow Pages.
Then, I guess inheriting an entire practice is quite convenient, isn't it? She said.
I didn't know what to say to her question, or the smarmy tone in which she said it. All I can tell you, Judge, is that I would take good care of Jerry Vincent's clients. The judge nodded, but she didn't look at me as she did so. I knew the tell. She knew something, and it bothered her. Maybe she knew about the rehab.
According to bar records, you've been disciplined several times, she said.
Here we were again. She was back to throwing the cases to another lawyer. Probably some campaign contributor from Century City who couldn't find his way around a criminal proceeding if his Riviera membership depended on it. All of it ancient history, Judge. All of it technicalities. I'm in good standing with the bar. If you called them today, then I'm sure you were told that.
She stared at me for a long moment before dropping her eyes to the document in front of her desk.
Very well, then, she said. She scribbled a signature on the last page of the document. I felt the flutter of excitement begin to build in my chest.
Here is an order transferring the practice to you, the judge said. You might need it when you go to his office. And let me tell you this. I am going to be monitoring you. I want an updated inventory of cases by the beginning of next week. The status of every case on the client list. I want to know which clients will work with you and which will find other representation. After that, I want bi-weekly status updates on all cases in which you remain counsel. Am I being clear?
Perfectly clear, Judge. For how long?
What?
For how long do you want me to give you bi-weekly updates?
She stared at me, and her face hardened.
Until I tell you to stop. She handed me the order.
You can go now, Mr. Haller. And if I were you, I would get over there and protect my new clients from any unlawful search and seizure of their files by the police. If you have any problem, you can always call on me. I've put my after-hours number on the order.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good luck, Mr. Haller.
I stood up and headed out of the room. When I got to the doorway of her chambers, I glanced back at her. She had her head down and was working on the next court order. Out in the courthouse hallway, I read the two-page document the judge had given me, confirming that what had just happened was real. It was. The document I held appointed me substitute counsel, at least temporarily, on all of Jerry Vincent's cases. It granted me immediate access to the fallen attorney's office, files, and bank accounts into which client advances had been deposited. I pulled out my cell phone and called Lorna Taylor. I asked her to look up the address of Jerry Vincent's office. She gave it to me and I told her to meet me there and to pick up two sandwiches on the way.
Why?
She asked.
Because I haven't had lunch.
No, why are we going to Jerry Vincent's office?
Because we're back in business.
I was in my Lincoln, driving toward Jerry Vincent's office, when I thought of something and called Lorna Taylor back. When she didn't answer, I called her cell and caught her in her car. I'm going to need an investigator. How would you feel if I called Cisco? There was a hesitation before she answered.
Sisko was Dennis Wojciechowski, her significant other, as of the past year. I was the one who had introduced them when I used him on a case. Last I heard, they were now living together.
Well, I have no problem working with Sisko, but I wish you would tell me what this is all about.
Lorna knew Jerry Vincent as a voice on the phone. It was she who would take his calls when he was checking to see if I could stand in on a sentence or babysit a client through an arraignment. I couldn't remember if they'd ever met in person. I had wanted to tell her the news in person, but things were moving too quickly for that.
Jerry Vincent is dead.
What?
He was murdered last night, and I'm getting first shot at all of his cases, including Walter Elliott.
She was silent for a long moment before responding.
My God, how? He was such a nice man.
I couldn't remember if you had ever met him. Lorna worked out of her condo in West Hollywood. All my calls and billing went through her. If there was a brick-and-mortar office for the law firm of Michael Haller and Associates, then her place was it. But there weren't any associates, and when I worked, my office was the back seat of my car. This left few occasions for Lorna to meet face-to-face with any of the people I represented or associated with.
He came to our wedding, don't you remember?
That's right. I forgot.
I can't believe this. What happened?
I don't know. Holder said he was shot in the garage at his office. Maybe I'll find out something when I get there.
Did he have a family?
I think he was divorced, but I don't know if there were kids or what. I don't think so. Lorna didn't say anything. We both had our own thoughts occupying us.
Let me go so I can call Sisko, I finally said.
Do you know what he's doing today?
No, he didn't say.
All right, I'll see.
What kind of sandwich do you want?
Which way are you coming?
Sunset.
Stop at Dusty's and get me one of those turkey sandwiches with cranberry sauce. It's been almost a year since I've had one of those.
You got it.
And get something for Sisko in case he's hungry.
All right.
I hung up and looked up the number for Dennis Wojciechowski in the address book I keep in the center console compartment. I had his cell phone. When he answered, I heard a mixture of wind and exhaust blast in the phone. He was on his bike, and even though I knew his helmet was set up with an earpiece and mic attached to his cell, I had to yell, "It's Mickey Haller! Pull over!" I waited and heard him cut the engine on his 63 Panhead.
"What's up, Mick?"
he asked when it finally got quiet.
"Haven't heard from you in a long time."
"You gotta put the baffles back in your pipes, man, or you'll be deaf before you're 40 and then you won't be hearing from anybody."
"I'm already past 40, and I hear you just fine. What's going on?"
Wojciechowski was a freelance defense investigator I had used on a few cases. That was how he had met Lorna, collecting his pay. But I had known him for more than 10 years before that, because of his association with the Road Saints Motorcycle Club, a group for which I served as a de facto house counsel for several years. Dennis never flew RSMC colors, but was considered an associate member. The group even bestowed a nickname on him, largely because there was already a Dennis in the membership, known, of course, as Dennis the Menace, and his last name, Wojciechowski, was intolerably difficult to pronounce. Riffing off his dark looks and mustache, they christened him the Sisko Kid. It didn't matter that he was 100% Polish out of the south side of Milwaukee. Sisko was a big, imposing man, but he kept his nose clean while riding with the Saints. He never caught an arrest record, and that paid off when he later applied to the state for his private investigator's license. Now, many years later, the long hair was gone and the mustache was trimmed and going gray. But the name Sisko and the penchant for riding classic Harleys built in his hometown had stuck for life. Sisko was a thorough and thoughtful investigator, and he had another value as well. He was big and strong, and could be physically intimidating when necessary. That attribute could be highly useful when tracking down and dealing with people who fluttered around the edges of a criminal case.
"First of all, where are you?" I asked.
"Burbank."
"You on a case?"
"Nah, just a ride.
Why, you got something for me? You taking on a case finally?"
"A lot of cases. And I'm going to need an investigator." I gave him the address of Vincent's office and told him to meet me there as soon as he could. I knew that Vincent would have used either a stable of investigators or just one in particular, and that there might be a loss of time as Sisko got up to speed on the cases. But all of that was okay with me. I wanted an investigator I could trust and already had a working relationship with.
I was also going to need Cisco to immediately start work by running down the locations of my new clients. My experience with criminal defendants is that they're not always found at the addresses they put down on the client info sheet when they first sign up for legal representation. After closing the phone, I realized I had driven right by the building where Vincent's office was located. It was on Broadway near 3rd Street, and there was too much traffic with cars and pedestrians for me to attempt a U-turn. I wasted 10 minutes working my way back to it, catching red lights at every corner. By the time I got to the right place, I was so frustrated that I resolved to hire a driver again as soon as possible, so that I could concentrate on cases instead of addresses. Vincent's office was in a 6-story structure called simply the Legal Center. Being so close to the main downtown courthouses, both criminal and civil, meant it was a building full of trial lawyers. Just the kind of place most cops and doctors, lawyer haters, probably wished would implode every time there was an earthquake. I saw the opening for the parking garage next door and pulled in. As I was taking the ticket out of the machine, a uniformed police officer approached my car. He was carrying a clipboard. "Sir, do you have business in the building here?" "That's why I'm parking here." "Sir, could you state your business?" "What business is it of yours, officer?" "Sir, we are conducting a crime scene investigation in the garage, and I need to know your business before I can allow you in." "My office is in the building," I said. "Will that do?" It wasn't exactly a lie. I had Judge Holder's court order in my coat pocket. That gave me an office in the building. The answer seemed to work. The cop asked to see my ID, and I could have argued that he had no right to request my identification.